Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Mark for asking me about an hour and a half ago if I would do this. It's better to not think about it anyways. Okay, my sobriety date is August 16th, 1992, and my home group is the West Portland Group in Portland, Oregon. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, etc. And I'm in contact with that sponsor, and for the most part, I do what she suggests. And I definitely do what's suggested in the big book, because I am a real alcoholic. I have 10 minutes just to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and some of you heard it just a few nights ago, so hopefully there's some consistency here. I did live it, but I wasn't really paying close attention because I never knew I was going to have to tell it. I am a person that has always been uncomfortable in my own skin. I was profoundly shy and suffered from feelings of being on the outside and apart from. And when I was 16 years old, my mom had divorced my father a few years prior, and everything was supposed to be well and good in our house because he was a practicing alcoholic. And we went to a wedding, and there were some popular kids there, and I felt very uncomfortable, and I've shared that I was very upset that the bride was getting a lot of attention and that I wasn't getting more attention, even though I was just a 16-year-old girl attending her wedding. And yet, if you looked at me and maybe giggled or looked at someone else and made any kind of expression, I thought that you were talking badly about me. So I really suffered from just self. It was about me always. This was my planet. You were just visiting, and you need to all behave. And no one ever behaved the way I thought they should. And at that reception, this really popular kid, Dennis, pushed a beer across the counter at the kitchen table, and it didn't even occur to me to not take a drink. My father had been drinking my whole life, and it had destroyed their marriage, and it had killed his father and was killing his brothers and sisters, and everyone in my family of lineage was dying from or had died from alcoholism. But I knew that if I just didn't do it the way my father did it, I would not be an alcoholic like him, because, you know, he just didn't know how to drink right. And so this wasn't what I was consciously thinking at 16, but I had this sense of being, you know, my case is different. And I drank that beer, just a couple of gulps, and prior to that drinking of that beer, I felt very uncomfortable. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to leave. I wanted more attention, but I didn't like the attention you were giving me. I was just very uncomfortable in my own skin. And I put a few gulps of beer in my body, and I believe this is what makes me alcoholic. I looked up from that kitchen table, and the room had changed. And it went from being sort of a hostile, uncomfortable place that I didn't fit into to a place where I realized, you're lucky I'm here. And aren't you glad I showed up? And who really cares what you think anyway? And for me, that, you know, I've talked to my mom, who's not alcoholic. When she drinks, she feels what they talk about in the big book. I mean, she just kind of feels a connection, conviviality, just, you know. And as soon as it starts to do what I think it should be doing, she stops and lets it evaporate. She drives me crazy. She does not need that, because the reality is that my mother naturally feels connected to the planet. She feels a part of. If people giggle across the room, she joins them and says, "What's so funny?" And never once does she think it's about her, ever. She's comfortable in her own skin. You know, she can function. But for me, from that moment until I got sober at age 28, I needed alcohol to be in my body. And every event that I attended, every guy that I dated, he had to look like, you know, he was 21, so he could buy alcohol. It didn't matter if he was hideous or, you know, going to be a felon someday. He had to be able to buy alcohol. And I chased that for 12 years. And I know 12 years isn't a long drinking career, but I gave it a real, you know, college try, and I did very well out there. And in college, I actually attended college. I met this gentleman in the front row here, and he was a worse alcoholic than me. And we dated briefly. He was a blackout drunk, and I actually wasn't much. I was kind of a brownout drunk, because I'm a big puker, and I didn't like to walk around with vomit in my hair, so I kind of tried to, you know, monitor it. I'm a controlling alcoholic. Of course, as a sponsee back there, that he likes to pay his bills when he's drinking. You know, we're responsible. And we're just not a lot of fun, but we're trying to survive. I have a terminally progressive disease, and I believe that alcohol saved me from that disease. I really think that I would have blown my brains out at some point because I was so uncomfortable and so insane in my head. When I came to AA and they talked about the committee, I understood what that was, that there was such a loud volume of chatter in my head, and the only thing that took that down was alcohol, the only thing. Pot made me paranoid, and other drugs, it didn't work for me. I had to drink. That was my solution. Anyway, I dated this guy briefly. I told him to not come around when he was wasted. He came over one night wasted. I laid the ground rules down again. Don't come around when you're wasted. And he said, oh, he's wasted. And, you know, always drunk. And he was always drunk. And he reminded me of my father. He was attractive and he was drunk. And I loved him because that's my favorite kind of guy. But he went away. He got sober. And we were friends briefly after he got sober. He was 6 months sober when I graduated college. And I realized that the problem was Oregon. So I moved to California. And I ended up in Hollywood, California, with a teaching degree. And it turns out I have a degree in elementary ed, and I don't like kids. No offense. I love kids. I just don't want to teach your kids. I want to be able to spank them. It's an issue. But I'm just kidding. But it wasn't the profession for me. And I ended up in a really violent relationship. And I was not abused. I abused. And he would try to hurt me, but I would hurt him worse. I have a horrible temper. And, you know, I was living in this beautiful place, and I was completely and utterly despairing. I was absolutely dying. I was dying. And Chris came and visited. He was 5.5 years sober. And I went down to Laguna Hills, and he said, we just were driving around. He said, you know, Barb, you deserve to be happy. You're darn right I do. And you're it, you know. And so I thought, well, you know, I really dig this guy. I think that I could make a go of it back in Oregon. So I left everything, left that crazy long-haired pretty boy that I was dating, and I moved up to Oregon. And within about 3 weeks, he was 5.5 years sober. I just quit drinking so that I could be around him as a sober man. And within just a very few weeks, I went completely and utterly insane because I had absolutely no relief. And I had actually never tried to quit drinking in my entire life because alcohol wasn't a problem. You were the problem. The job was the problem. The place I lived was a problem. The state I lived in was a problem. IRS was a problem. You know, everything on the outside was a problem, but no way was it alcohol. And I certainly wasn't an alcoholic because my dad was alcoholic and he did all these things and I never did those things. So within 3 weeks, the cops were called on us and I tried to jump out of the car as he was driving down the street, and we got in an argument and he pointed at me and I act like he'd hit me. You know, I was very theatrical. Everything was all theatrics. And I kind of drug this man down a little bit because the reality is that, you know, if you play tennis with someone that sucks and you're really good, you're going to suck. You play down in your game. That's the way it is. That's my experience. But we were in love, and by then we were engaged. And he said to me, you know, if you were to drink, Barb, what would you do? And I didn't really know how to get to the grocery store at that time, but I knew where people were drinking. Just, you know, had kind of documented that. So now I go down to Santa Fe. This is a bar in our neighborhood. I have a double shot Corvo Gold with a beer back, head over to the Mission Theater where they serve, you know, pitchers of dark beer. And because I like to be in clubs, I like to be out there. Only alcoholics drink at home. And I drank at home, but I didn't drink at home, you know, not like my dad. And he kind of paused and he looked at me and he said, what would your mom do? And I said, my mom would order a grasshopper and watch it evaporate because she's never finished a full drink of anything in her life. She's never had a full glass of anything. She thinks alcohol is a beverage. Lulu and I were talking about that. Non-alcoholics think alcohol is a beverage. And I don't understand that way of thinking. And he said, what would your father do? And I said, my dad would go down to Santa Fe. He'd have a double shot Corvo Gold with a beer back. And my dad is an admitted alcoholic. And I looked at Chris and I said, oh my God, am I an alcoholic? And he said, I can't tell you that. It's a self-diagnosed disease. I called the hotline, the old man on the other end. And I always say old. He was probably how old I am now. He's probably about 43. Old man. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, and I knew this was the solution. I said, I need to drink. I want to drink because I can think clearly if I get about 5 or 6 drinks in me. Then everything makes sense. There are no problems. What was the problem again? And he suggested I go to an AA meeting. I went to an AA meeting the next day, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so lucky that the first meeting I went to, they honored the singleness of purpose. Everyone talked about alcoholism. It saved my life. I don't have experience in anything else. What was killing me was that. Alcoholism, alcohol consumption, the ism, the committee that lived between my ears, it was killing me. And I was spiritually and emotionally dead on arrival. And you guys saved my life. You absolutely shared from your heart, your experience, strength, and hope about your alcoholism. And I identified and I was hooked. I've been sober almost 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I've been married almost 15 years to the same man. We decided not to have children, let you guys give birth to the Antichrist, because it's not going to be us. but, you know, I've raised two dogs, which I'm very proud of, because when I was drinking, I was not responsible. I was not abusive, but I was neglectful, and that's abuse. And we had to put down our dog, that my sober dog that I have tattooed on my back. He's my absolute, my best teacher. And he taught me how to do a 10th step immediately. When you're screaming at your dog so much your throat starts to bleed, you probably need to work a step. And and we put down this dog together as husband and wife, and we cried and we walked through that, because that's just a humongous pain. It's like a child. And a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and we walked through that sober. And every night I have to give myself an injection. Now I'm an IV drug user. And it's not mind or mood altering. It just slows down the disease. But I'm here to say, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, there is nothing that I have found necessary to drink over. There's a lot of things that have kind of come up, but it's never been the big stuff. A lot of it's been, oh my God, it's Thursday. You know, it's the little stuff for me. The way I don't drink is I stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do what you guys do. I was told if you get out on the outside of the pack, you will get picked off. Bottom line, that's how it works. And I'm an alcoholic. I have a terminally progressive disease. I will die from this, but I'm not a very lucky person per se. I won't die from it fast enough. I won't. And I will live a miserable, pathetic, horrible existence, which is what everyone in my family has done. I'm the only sober person in my family. And I got to tell you, this is the best deal in town. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, and I bet you are if you're here tonight, there's a solution here. There's a family here. There's a place that you never have to drink again, even if you want to. And anything is possible. You can walk through all of it, because we will carry you. Absolutely. Thank
you. And at this time, I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Chris from Portland.
My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987. And my home group is the West Portland group. And I want to thank Mark for asking me to do this. It's an honor to be here and be a part of your fourth birthday, the High Desert Big Book group. And, you know, only in Alcoholics Anonymous do you attend barbecues where the guy with the spatula comes running around the corner saying, screaming, call 911, it's going to blow. But I, you know, I understand that the alcoholic thinking that goes into that. I don't know this because I wasn't watching the barbecue, but I'm sure that he thought that the gas, he'd turn it to a certain level, and then he thought, you know, probably a little bit more is better. So, anyway, I'm grateful to be sober, and grateful to do this. I don't know if anybody will get anything out of anything I have to say tonight, but I know that when I share my experience with the idea that it may help somebody, it enlarges my spiritual life, and I get to stay sober, and I get to grow. So for that, I'm grateful. My drinking career was only 11 years long, and for whatever reason, it progressed very rapidly. In those 11 years, I was arrested 15 or 16 different times for alcohol-related arrests, and had three DUIs, two treatment centers, wound up in detox, ended up in hospitals because of alcohol withdrawal. I was somebody that would, I had the early stages of DTs when I'd come off of alcohol. I ended up becoming a daily oblivion drinker at the end. I was a daily drinker the majority of my drinking career. At the end, I became a daily oblivion drinker where, unlike people that want to pay their bills and stuff, my life was more like drink or pay bills, and I'd drink. Drink or work, and I would drink. I was essentially living to drink. And just to give you an idea of where my head can go today, still, a couple, probably 3-4 years ago, I guess now, I was speaking at a meeting, and before I went in to to do my talk, I was kind of thinking how I was going to lead into my talk, and I decided I'd give, you know, the highlights of my drinking, you know, 15, 16 arrests, you know, I wet the bed on a regular basis, became a daily oblivion drinker, detoxes, treatment center, auditory hallucinations when I come off of alcohol, so forth. And I went through that list, and then a little voice in my head said, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. And, you know, there was a time in my life where the insanity that preceded the first drink would start with a thought just like that. Because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to live this way of life, I recoiled from that thought as from a hot flame, and it never bothered me again. I did a little 10-step work on it, too. I talked to some people. But there was a time in my life where that was the exact thought that would lead me back to drinking. Maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. I got sober when I was 21 years old, you know, and, you know, maybe I was just going through a phase. Maybe I've got an anxiety disorder, you know, maybe it's something other than alcoholism. And I would, and as insane as the idea would be, I would be convinced of it and drink again. And as a result of this program, I don't have those thoughts. Those thoughts don't take me to a drink. However, those things don't necessarily make me an alcoholic. Those things are just events that happened as a result of my drinking. They're a pretty good indication I might have a problem with alcohol, but they don't necessarily make me an alcoholic. What I believe makes me an alcoholic is that all my life, like Barb was saying, I always felt on the outside. I always felt different than everybody else. I felt alienated and apart from. I had this sense of impending insanity and impending doom. I was hypersensitive. You know, I too was somebody, if somebody just casually glanced at me across the room, I knew that they were judging me and judging me, you know, poorly. And I was hyper self-conscious. I was terrified of people. I was somebody that when not drinking, if I was walking down the sidewalk and somebody was coming the other way, I would cross the street and walk down the other side of the sidewalk so I could avoid eye contact. And if I did happen to muster the courage to stay on the same side of the sidewalk as that person, I'd look down at the concrete and please don't look at me. Please don't say hello, you know, and go through it. Now, when I had a certain amount of alcohol in my system, 8 to 10 drinks was my magic number. And 8 to 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought everybody else felt like normally. And I was able to get out there in life and participate and do the things that everybody else seemed to be doing naturally. I was able to walk down the street and glance at somebody in their eyes and say hello. I was able to go and be social, you know, to some extent. So alcohol was my solution. And the truth is that had I been able to maintain what 8 to 10 drinks had done for me, I never would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd be out there tonight drinking my 8 to 10 drinks and maintaining what 8 to 10 drinks did for me and living my life that way. However, I suffer from the phenomenon of craving and also a loss of control. After I have a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I get a craving that I cannot put out. And I total loss of control and I drink to excess. Early on, it was once in a while or 50% of the time. As my drinking progressed, it became more and more frequent until the end. I could not take a drink without totally losing control. So very early on in my drinking, I started suffering consequences as a result of my drinking. I wrecked my first car when I was 14 years old, ran away from home. I ran away from home on numerous occasions, always over alcohol. I was kicked out of high school as a result of my drinking. The main conversation in my family at the time was about my drinking. I went to a private college prep school where we drank very similar to the way that people drink in colleges. We had keggers on Thursday night, Friday afternoon, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday morning. And I drank to blackout throughout high school. And I drank out, you know, so very early on, drinking was the fuel that fired my boilers. It allowed me to get out there and live. And without the alcohol, I wasn't able to participate in life. Fast forwarding, and I should also mention that in addition to my drinking progressing, the alcoholism progressed as well. Those feelings of insanity, the sense of impending insanity, the anxiety, the feelings of different then. Those became worse and worse and worse. And I tried things to, tried to do things to compensate for that. I remember one time I was in a little town south of Portland. I lived in Portland, grew up in Portland, and I was down in this town, Eugene, the University of Oregon's down there. And I was watching some of the people at college to try to see how the normal people act in life. And I suddenly realized that most of the men in school, the young men in school, wore belts. And I thought, that's it. I need a belt. And so I went into this store, and I got a belt, and I really believed, and this is just one example of many, but I really believed that doing things like that would transform me and bring me into the middle of, not you guys, but people out there. I got the belt, and I put it on, and then there was suddenly the sense of like, it's not really it either, And it was just one thing after another, trying to fit and be a part of and failing all the time. Alcohol was it. It was the only thing that brought me close. Early in my drinking, I believe that most of my drinking was relief drinking. I was like a pressure cooker. I was somebody that I just kept building and building and building, and I needed that alcohol to let that steam out. I've heard that people say that they believe that alcohol literally preserved their sanity. I really believe it did. I believe had I not had alcohol, I would have just totally snapped. Later in my drinking, not only did it give me relief, but it allowed me to go out and be a participant in life and be as I became the person that I always wanted to be under a certain amount of alcohol. Fast forwarding in the fall of 1985, by this time I'd been trying to control and enjoy my drinking or quit altogether on many different, and I did all the things that we try to do. I tried drinking glasses of water in between drinks, thinking that would be the solution. And the only thing that did is I wet the bed earlier in the night than I normally would had I not drank all that water. I did things like I'd create plans. I would actually write out a plan of how I was going to drink. I was going to drink only on Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, taper off on Sundays. Unless there was a female involved, and then just kind of get over the social jitters, I would drink, And I would create these plans, and I would drink. I mean, I just could not stick to anything in terms. So I tried everything to quit and control my drinking. The fall of 1985, I had a conversation with myself where I thought, I've been battling this alcohol for a long time now, and I'm just tired of it. I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to face the fact that I'm a drinker. I'm somebody that drinks. I'm no longer going to control it. I'm not going to try to quit. I'm just going to drink when I want to drink, however much I want to drink, and just see what happens. And what happened is I went 3 weeks, and I blacked out every night for those 3 weeks. I'd come to in the morning, put together about 4 or 5 hours in the morning until I could regain my strength and start drinking again. And I'd drink again. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I had this little thought, and that was, my God, am I ever going to be able to stop this? But it was the next thought was, I don't care. Because that was the best I had ever done in my entire life. My entire life, that was the happiest I'd ever been. I've heard said that that alcoholism is the only fatal progressive disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. And it lasted for about 2 months. And at the end of the 2 months, the problems started coming back and started mounting. And one more time, I tried to quit and started trying to control my drinking. And by that time, I had become a daily oblivion drinker. And my days consisted of getting up in the morning, rehashing as much of the night before as I could, feeling just a deep, deep sense of shame, guilt, and remorse, which was something I'd been living with for a long time. And then I would swear off. And I would create, sometimes it was a plan where I would have this strategic plan of action of how I wasn't going to drink that day. Or it was just I'm done. That's it. I'm done. And the night before may have been a night of trouble and problems and pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Or it may have just been a night of excessive drinking. But somewhere a few hours after that, something would happen and I would have that insane thought. And it would be like, well, maybe if I only drink this way tonight, then I could control and enjoy my drinking. Or it may be like the big book says, where I just, screw it, I'm drinking, and drink. And I did that over and over and over, day in and day out. The last 12 months of my drinking, I was arrested 9 times for drinking-related offenses. And finally, what happened is, in June of 1986, I'd come off a really bad drunk, and by this time, I was starting to go into the early stages of DTs when I would try to come off of alcohol. And I knew I had to, you know, I'd pieced the night together the night before. I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that, you know. So what I did, I lived in a town in southern Oregon, right on the California-Oregon border called Ashland. And I decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to wean myself off of alcohol. I got out on the freeway and I hitchhiked up to Portland. I'd lost my license by this time for 3 years. And the first day I drank 5 or 6 beers, something like that. And then the next night I drank like 3 or 4 beers. The next night I didn't drink any. So either 3 or 4 days that I weaned myself off of alcohol. But anyway, on that last night, I just came apart. My head started racing and I couldn't stop, and I was shaking. I wasn't somebody that had the shakes that was visible from the outside. I had like the internal tremors, but I always felt like this. I mean, I just was like this, and you couldn't see that I was shaking, but I was shaking, you know. And I'd hear voices and organ music when I'd come off of alcohol, and I was just coming apart. And so I checked into a detox, and I went into the detox. They pumped me full of Librium, monitored my blood pressure around the clock for 5 days. And in that detox, there was people coming in that were far more advanced than I was, I thought, because they were seeing things come out of the wall and so forth. And a couple guys, I guess, probably came in, were in there for 3 days. They were ejected into the regular population. And I suddenly knew what was happening in this treatment center, because this detox was attached to a treatment center. And that was that there was a conspiracy developing where they were holding me in the detox longer than I was really necessary in order to make me think that I was really worse than I really was. And then the treatment center closer, who was the staff physician, had given me a physical. She sat me down and went through the various stages of liver damage and where you ended up with cirrhosis, and told me that I would probably have full-blown cirrhosis within 5 years, and if I didn't, I'd have it within 10 years. And again, I knew what they were doing. They were trying to convince me that I was actually worse than I was, so I would stay for their inpatient treatment, which I didn't bite on. I stayed for the treatment because my insurance wouldn't cover the detox unless I stayed for the inpatient. Stayed for the inpatient treatments and went through it, and I desperately wanted to drink. I mean, desperately wanted to not drink. I did not want to drink. My plan was to get through the withdrawal, get out there, get sober, and put this alcoholism thing behind me. And I went through the treatment. I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I was exposed I'll come back to that because I'm going to try to say something about your group at the end. But about 2 weeks out of the treatment center, I was drinking again. And, you know, and I'd done the tests, you know, I won't go into detail on that, but I was out drinking again. And I wound up back in Ashland, and this is where my last job, or it was one of my last, this is my second to last job in my drinking. I'd worked 3 weeks. I could always put together about 3 weeks of work, and then I'd blow it. And I had gone out this one night, and I drank all night, and I was working a very physical job, and I went out the next day just sick, you know, and I was just like, I will never do that again. And I did it again. And so I didn't go to work because I vowed to never put myself through anything like that again. I got in my car. I bought a case of beer. It was about 7 a.m. Bought a case of beer, drank it, drove 5 hours south down to Ashland, picked up 2 hitchhikers, stopped at a bar in Ashland, which was my favorite watering hole, went in and started drinking in the bar, had the hitchhikers keep my car safe on the curb in case anybody came because I was parked in a no parking zone. And of course, they stole the car. And I called the police. The police came, picked me up, and they had already caught these thieves. They happened to be driving right past the police station. Cops took me down, and they said, are these the guys? And yes, these are the guys. And they said, well, you gave them permission to move the car and so forth, so we can't keep them. However, you have the right to remain silent. And they start, you know, and they arrested me. They arrested me on a warrant for parking tickets or something. And as I started throwing a fit, they said, look, you can either get your fourth DUI or you can spend the day in jail and sober up. So I went into jail and attempted to hang myself from the toilet with the sheets, which was not a real effective way to try to kill yourself. Threw a little baby fit in there. Went through all the extremes of emotions that I would normally go through, the guilt, the shame, the remorse, and then my constant mantra was, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Went through all that. Finally, they let me out that evening, maybe 5-6 o'clock, and you know what I did? I went straight to the bars, because now I had a story. I spent the day in jail, you know? And that was kind of the way I was drinking at the end of my drinking. I made a geographic soon after that up to Ketchikan, Alaska. I went to work for a dry logging camp. It was an hour and a half float plane ride from Ketchikan, and there was no liquor. There was no liquor, you know, anywhere. I went up there, I worked for 3 weeks, and two guys showed up with a bottle of whiskey. And when they showed up with the whiskey, you know, they asked if I wanted a drink. And very quickly in my mind, I went through the calculation. Well, it's been 3 weeks. I haven't had any cravings for alcohol. I haven't had a desire. Da, 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 da. I must not be an alcoholic. Sure, I'll take it. They handed me the bottle, and I took about 3 big gulps out of this bottle, and they grabbed it, and they said, hey, we got to make this last. I had thought that we were going to just drink the bottle. Now, the problem with that is, as I mentioned, I suffer from that phenomenon of craving. So I literally sat in Ketchikan, Alaska, on a floating logging camp, an hour and a half float plane ride away from the nearest liquor, with about 3 or 4 drinks in me. And I had like this itch that I could not scratch. I mean, was coming apart. I wanted to drink so bad. So the next morning, I caught a float plane into Ketchikan and went in there with this guy from the logging camp, Dan. We went to his bar called the Fo'c'sle Bar, which is this notorious bar up there where loggers and fishermen drink and fight and so forth. And just to give you an idea, the type of bar it is, when you order a drink up there, if you order, say, Jim Beams or something, they don't give you a glass of Jim Beams. They give you the bottle with the glass on top of the bottle. Anyway, I sat down with this guy, Dan, and we had 3 or 4 drinks in us. And after his fourth drink, a light bulb went off in his head, and he turned to me and he said, you think you're pretty badass, don't you? And the night just erupted from there. And I started in and out of a blackout, but the last thing one of the last things I remember is the Ketchikan Police Department knocking me around quite a bit. And they took me in, threw me into a holding cell with 2 other guys. And in that holding cell, I passed out. And in the morning when I came to, the guy that was on the top bunk of the holding cell was hanging over. And I should say also, this is the beginning of a series of coincidences that started happening in my life that led me finally to Alcoholics Anonymous. But this guy on the top bunk was hanging over the top bunk looking at me. And when I opened my eyes, he was, you know, there he was. And I said, can I help you? And he said, he goes, my name's such and such. He goes, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, I've got 30 days sober in the program. I'm doing 10 days of jail time because my sponsor had me come in here and I owed an amends to the jail and owed this jail time. And, you know, my initial thought at the time was, you know, my God, I can't even get away from these AA people here. But the reality is looking back on it, is that's, like I said, it's a series of coincidences that that happened. Anyway, I went to court that day and was released, got on a plane back to Seattle. And as the plane was taking off from Ketchikan, never once did I think it's a drinking problem. I thought, I'll never come to Alaska again. And anyway, I ended up back down in Southern Oregon soon after that, and I owed 8 days of jail time, and during those 8 days of jail time, which I was doing on weekends, I was arrested between the 3rd and the 4th weekend, and on a Wednesday, and the police, who had known me by, you know, my first name by now, said, you know, Chris, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You got to go see this guy, Joe Fisher. He's an expert on alcoholism. You know, he can help you out. And, I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. And the next day or the next couple days, I was walking down the street, and there was one of these sidewalk preachers that that reads scripture to anybody that happens to be coming by. And he read something, and I have no idea what it was. But somehow it seemed to be kind of correlated between what the police had said to me about seeing this guy, Joe Fisher. And I thought, you know, if I was one of those AA people, I would say, There's no coincidences. You know, this must be some sort of fate. This is God working in my life. And I kind of dismissed it, took a few more steps, and then I thought, what if for once in my life I didn't dismiss this type of stuff as being trivial and being stupid and actually acted on it? And so almost out of my own, for my own amusement, I did act on it. I went and saw this guy, Joe Fisher. I went up there and I went into his office, and right before I was going into his office, all I could think of is I didn't want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't like the talk about God in AA. I didn't like the Lord's Prayer, and I didn't want to join a fellowship. I wasn't exactly a joiner, and I was just like, please, anything besides Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time, I was really looking into the Schick Center, you know, 10 days, a couple, two-day follow-ups, and just get this whole thing behind me. And so I was hoping that's what his experience was. And it wasn't. It was AA. And he told me the story, his story, and at the end of telling me his story, invited me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I did not want to go to, but I went to out of a sense of obligation since I did ask him for help. And that was a Thursday night Clay Street meeting in Ashland, Oregon. And interestingly enough, that meeting has some relationships down here. Tom Green from the Pacific Group, I think Clancy sponsors him, is the guy that started that group. And that group was a group that was a primary purpose group. It was a singleness of purpose group. When there was somebody who was new, it was a speaker discussion meeting. And generally, the speaker would talk on a topic after telling their story, and then the participants would talk about the topic. But when there was somebody that was new, what they would do is they would cater to that newcomer, and they would tell a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what it was like now. Now, I'd never been to an AA meeting like that before. I'd been to meetings where they talked about all sorts of other stuff where I sat there and, you know, didn't identify. And as they were going around the room, you know, telling their stories, I started to identify. And it's like, you know, I drank like that. I felt like that. I thought like that. And little by little, you know, and these people weren't drinking. They had 6 months sober, years sober, 5 years sober, and so forth. And then there was this one guy that stood up. And he talked about coming out of a blackout holding a revolver in his mouth. And then he went back into the blackout and came to the next morning on the floor with a revolver next to him. And that gave me goosebumps because I had exactly the same thing happen to me, almost. I had gone up for a wisdom tooth to get extracted a wisdom tooth. And before I went into the dentist, I drank a 12-pack of beer, had the wisdom tooth extracted, got out of the dentist, and drank a fifth of vodka. And they had given me some pain pills. They said, don't take any of these, you know, while you're drinking. And so I took a few. And then I ended up, after the fifth of vodka, I got into an altercation, ended up back at my house, and was working on the next bottle. And next thing I remember, I came out of a blackout, and I was holding a carving knife to my stomach. And then I went back into the blackout and came to later and with a knife on the floor. And the only difference between his story and my story is I had broken every dish in the house and knifed all the furniture to death somewhere in that blackout. But that's the first time I'd ever heard anybody say anything like that. I thought I was the only person that did things like that. And so anyway, I came out of there with a sense of hope for the first time. Enough hope that I stayed sober the entire next day, which was miraculous for me because I was a daily oblivion drinker. And I drank again after that, because I didn't keep coming back and I didn't take any action. On February 4th, 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I could control and enjoy my drinking. And my plan was I was going to drink 10 drinks that night, and I was going to shut it off, come home early, be like a regular person, get up the next day, and be like, you know, everybody else. The guy that was supposed to pick me up to take me down to the bars didn't arrive. He was late. I drank 9 beers sitting there waiting for him in my living room before he even picked me up. Went down to the bars, was drinking vodka Collins at one bar, started fading in and out of a blackout, ended up at my normal bar, had secured a job as a bartender at my favorite drinking establishment because that was one of those ideas, you know, that's going to be the solution. If I'm a bartender, then I'll be okay. And this guy cut me off, and the guy that was going to give me the job cut me off. And so I yanked him across the bar and was going to work him over on the bar. He kind of weaseled his way away from me, ran into the walk-in refrigerator where there was a phone, called the police. I ran out the front door and started running through people's backyards. Ended up passing out behind some bushes, and the police, you know, kind of kicked me too. And Anyway, and then they arrested me. And before they arrested me, something happened somewhere in my soul, but it just snapped, and I couldn't do it anymore. And they hadn't cuffed me as of yet, and one of the cops was standing there with his revolver right there. And I thought, I can't do this. I can't do this any longer. I'm not going to go to jail anymore. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to grab the revolver, and I'm going to shoot this guy and flee. And then my next thought was, no, I get arrested for everything. I get caught for everything. I'm going to grab his revolver and shoot myself. Screw this. I'm done. And I don't know if I would have acted on that or not. They cuffed me before I could have. It may have just been a fleeting, drunken thought, or maybe I would have. I have no idea. But something changed that night. And my last conscious thought, they took me home later that night. My last conscious thought before I passed out was, I wonder if I'll feel this way in the morning. And when I came to in the morning, I did. I was beat. I was totally beat by alcohol. Death at that point was a more attractive alternative than to continue living the way I was living. And, you know, had I had a crystal ball that morning that said if I would just drink for another 3 months or another 6 months, I would have drank myself to death. I mean, if I would have died, you know, at the end of that drinking. My fear was is that I was going to continue living. I was going to live another year or another 2 years or another 5 years and continue to spiral further and further down in this hell that I was living. And I cried out to a God that I did not want to believe in. And I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. And I became willing that morning to go into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became willing to stop fighting anything or anyone to, you know, to go in there. And if it meant believing in God, I was going to believe in God. If it meant holding hands at the end of the meetings and saying the Lord's Prayer, I would hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And if it meant doing all sorts of stuff that seemed like it had no relevance to my alcoholism, I would do that stuff too. So I got sober in this meeting, this Clay Street group. And you know, they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a big book, read the big book, start working the steps, get a sponsor, get a service commitment, put first things first. You know, they really believed that you had to put sobriety ahead of everything in order to stay sober. And I did it, and I started doing it. And the obsession to drink was removed from me immediately. And I honestly believe that that morning, February 5th, that I did steps 1, 2, and 3 that morning, and I didn't even know it. I did them formally out of the book later on, but I believe here in my soul, I did them that morning. And I started forming a relationship with a higher power. You know, the God thing bothered me. The Lord's Prayer bothered me, but I did this stuff anyway. You know, I acted as if. And I found out in the chapter, We Agnostics, that it's not required of me to believe in a God. It's what's required for me is to be willing to believe. And they said that that would be a foundation. That would be enough of a foundation to make a start in this program. One guy said it in a way that I really liked. He said, you don't have to believe in God to make a start in this program. You just have to take actions as if you believe in God. And I could do that. I could act as if I believed in God and start taking actions as if I did. And through these actions and doing all these things, I started to form a relationship with a higher power. And all was well until about 44 days of sobriety. I ended up having a panic attack, which I landed in a hospital. I belonged to a group that warned me about doctors. They said that to be careful. Doctors have just discovered that alcoholism is caused by a Valium deficiency. And that, and sure enough, as I was in there, of course, they tried to pump me full of Valium, which I didn't take. And I never had a panic attack. I had a lot of anxiety before, but I never had a panic attack. Now, the truth is that I had a secret. And the secret was, is that, yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a horrible alcoholic. But the other thing is that I'm crazy. And that is, you know, I'm nuts. And all that, what I was calling being crazy, the sense of impending insanity, the sense of impending doom, the feelings of being different than and so forth, the anxiety and fear, I later found out it's called alcoholism. But I thought it was craziness. You know, see, the thing is alcohol, drinking didn't cause my alcoholism. Alcoholism caused my drinking. And luckily, I found a guy in that group that I heard him say one morning, he said, you know, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. And I was like, I identify with that. And anyway, he became my sponsor. And so I stayed sober. And in one aspect, my life started going better. But I still had this anxiety, these panic attacks all the time, and these fears and hatred towards people and, you know, all this other stuff. And just to give you an idea of the emotional mindset that I was suffering in by the time I got to be about 9 months sober, I was taking a psychology class. And in this psychology class, the doctor, the professor, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had 3.5 years. And it was a class that was based on stress. And he gave us one of these kind of self-diagnosing tests, kind of like the MMPI, but about half as long. And I took this test, and I answered it honestly because I was now in Alcoholics Anonymous and being honest, and I answered it. And it was an auditorium class, and there was probably like 100 or 150 people in this class. And we self-graded, and at the end he said, "Who here scored between 0 and 25? There's a handful of people that raised their hands. He said, "You guys, stress, you know, comes off you like water off a duck. Who here scored between 25 and 50? Majority of the class raised their hand. He said, "You guys process stress average, you know, you're normal. And who here scored between 50 and 75? The remaining maybe 10% of the class raised their hand. He said, "You guys have, you know, a stressor in your life. Maybe you've moved. Maybe you've been recently married. Maybe it's midterms, something like that. Who scored between 75 and 100? It was like two or three brave souls that raised their hand. He said, "You guys have a significant event, maybe a loss, you know, a death, a divorce, something like that, you know. Who scored between 100 and 125? Nobody. Anybody here score above 125? Nobody. Except me. I'd scored 146. And he said, "I didn't think that anybody scored above 125 because generally people above 125 are locked up in federal penitentiaries or institutionalized." So, you know, so that concerned me. I want to say that I have not done my fourth step at this point. And I went down to see this professor, and I said, "You know, my God, I've scored 146 on this thing, you know." And I felt like I should be institutionalized. I spent the first probably 60 days of my sobriety being grateful I was sober, but in a fetal position at night, knowing that I was going to be institutionalized at any moment. He said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "Anybody in their first year, especially if they hadn't done their fourth and fifth step yet, would score 146 on this." Now, this group that I belonged to had been urging me to do my fourth step for some time. They'd be like, "You know, do your fourth step. You're going to die. Do your fourth step, you know." And anyway, so I came away from there, and about a month later, I was just coming apart. And I made a phone call to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called him up and I said, "You know what? I'm having these panic attacks. You know, I mean, I never had this when I was drinking. You know, I'm going crazy." And he said something. He said to me, he goes, "You know, Chris, what you have is probably something that Alcoholics Anonymous can't help you with. It's something that's, you know, beyond that, and that you should probably go see, you know, a psychiatrist and maybe get on some medication for this." Now, at the time, they were dispensing, like I said, they were dispensing Valium for anxiety. And I hung up that phone and I thought, "My God, you know, I've been medicating myself all my life. I've been anesthetizing my emotions my entire life. And I thought I had a solution. I thought this thing was a spiritual malady." That's what it said. That's what they'd all been telling me. "And that these spiritual principles would solve all my problems. And here I am, you know, this well-meaning AA telling me to go get outside help." Nothing wrong with outside help. I'm not saying that. This is my experience. You know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I've been medicating myself all my life. Instead, what I'm going to do, I made the decision, I'm going to work the steps. I'm going to work steps 4 through 12 exactly as they're outlined in the big book. And if I get to step 12 and I still feel this way, I'm going to commit suicide. And so I started in. I did my fourth step. I got together with my sponsor, read my fifth step. Halfway through my fifth step, I had a spiritual experience that happened. All my life, I would go, my sober life, my dry life, when I didn't have those 10 drinks in me, I would go into the mirror and I would judge myself. I'd either tear myself down or build myself up. And it would come from somewhere in my soul. And I turned halfway through my fifth step to do that, and to do my normal routine. And nothing happened. And I started trying to identify what was going on with me. You know, what is this? What is this I'm experiencing? What is this feeling? And what it was comfort in my own skin. It was the first time I'd ever experienced comfort without those 10 drinks. And anyway, I finished my fist up. I did step 6 and 7 as they're outlined in the big book. 2 weeks later, I realized that nothing had changed in my life, but everything had changed. Something internally had switched. The anxiety was gone. Now, I've had problems with anxiety since then. I'm a human being, so I experience emotions. But that sheer panic and terror that I was experiencing, the feelings of being different than and apart from started to diminish. The self-pity that I'd lived with was a lot of that had diminished. I had changed. I'd become a person that I'd never had been before, except for with those 10 drinks. I went into steps 8 and 9. I was taught that the first 3 steps of becoming willing to turn your life over to God, the next steps 4 through 9 are actually turning them over to God, and steps 10 through 12 are how you keep it turned over. And I was on fire from the program after that. I had a spiritual experience. And, you know, I have found that in my sobriety that that's been the case. I react to life. I'm still bodily and mentally different than my fellows. I still react differently, but I'm comfortable in my reaction. I'm comfortable, as my wife sometimes says, I'm able to go and be amongst the earth people undetected. And you know, and in my sobriety, I mean, all sorts of wonderful things have happened. I had an intuitive thought when I was about 2.5-3 years sober that led me into the business I'm in today, and ended up becoming a 50% owner in the business that I'm in. I ended up getting married behind Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a participant in life. And I want to just close with, I'm running out of time, and I swore I was going to talk more on sobriety tonight, and somehow I didn't do it, but I want to talk a little bit about my experience with a home group, since this is your birthday meeting, and my home group's almost 4 years old as well. And when I left Ashland, Oregon, I moved to Portland when I was about 2.5 years sober. In Ashland, in Southern Oregon, the Alcoholics Anonymous was very enthusiastic. It was very singleness of purpose. It was there was a primary purpose. And they believed in the steps, and they believed in the big book, and they believed in sponsorship. And they believed in Alcoholics Anonymous as an entire way of life. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous was not something you did when convenient. You know, what you did outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, you did when convenient. And when I came to Portland, when I moved to Portland, which was where I'm originally from, you know, the metropolitan area, we have about 800 meetings a week. And I'd never been exposed to discussion meetings before where people had sat in circles and they'd go around the room and say things like, I had a really good day today. I had a really bad day today. I had a really good week today, this week. And they would have these topics, and there was very little singleness of purpose, and there was a blurring of the lines between other 12-step programs. Anything would go in these meetings. And I didn't fit. I didn't identify. My disease of perception and that sense of apartness still can act today. If 10 of you guys, if I walked into a room with 10 of you guys and you guys were talking about overeating, well, that's not a good one because I probably would relate a little bit to that one. but if you were talking about something, little by little, I'd start to feel apart from again. And I need to feel a part of. I need to go to some place where I feel a part of. Anyway, I ended up getting dry in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 6 years sober. Little by little, I slowed down on what worked for me. And I just went crazy. That anxiety and panic attacks came back. The hatred towards everybody came back. The fear of people. And I just went crazy. And through a moment of clarity and intuitive thought, I went down a path where I immersed myself back in Alcoholics Anonymous again. And when I immersed myself back in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was about a year and a half time period, I came out of there and I started a group. The group was called the Fifth Tradition Group. It was a great group. It was based on the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was structured, And it carried the message. But I didn't have much experience with starting groups and maintaining groups. And little by little, it got chipped away and diluted and diluted and diluted to where I left the group and everybody else that was a part of that group, the original group left. It ultimately became a Crystal Meth Anonymous meeting. So it went from Fifth Tradition to Crystal Meth Anonymous. From there, I started another group called the John's Landing Group, and myself and two other guys. And this is the John's Landing Group's a very active group in Portland. It's a sister group to my home group today. We'd made one mistake, however, and that was a couple of the guys that helped start the group had a sense of elitism. And they would they'd point their fingers at other groups and how they were doing it wrong and inappropriately and how they weren't really doing AA, which I agree with, but it was not a group of attraction. And it ended up becoming a group of where in that group, it's not a very warm or friendly group. It's a very fragmented group where they all join in clusters. And from there, I started what's the West Portland group. And the West Portland group, through all these learning the mistakes that we made, has become, it's a meeting that on Saturday night, we have 400 people every Saturday night at our group. Our Tuesday meeting, we have about 100. And then our Thursday and Friday, we probably have, 30 or 40 or so. And it's a very active group, and it's very structured. It's a lot like your guys' groups here. And I don't like to talk, I was telling somebody this before the meeting, I don't like to talk about how we come from the same ethic and that we grew up in the same sort of AA that has the same ethic. I don't believe that. I believe we grew up in AA. There's a different ethic out there that maybe barely resembles AA, but we're not some sort of special ethic. At least my home group, we're not. We're just AA. And in that AA, we're respectful. We're singleness of purpose. And the proof is that we have 400 people there every Saturday night, and we're very effective. We carry the message to the alcoholics who still suffers, and people stick. And there's newcomers that have gotten sober. One of my sponsees here tonight got sober in that group. So for whatever that's worth, I'm grateful for groups like this, and they're AA groups. And I really want to thank you guys for having me. In closing, I'd just like to say something that Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, and that is, today I have two choices. I can live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or I can live a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. Thanks for my sobriety.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.